ask our marshal, Joe Turan, to call court to order.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Flory, Judge Smith, the Honorable Judge Renee Werke presiding.
Counsel, I know that you're familiar with the Zoom platform, or at least you've been participating in court matters under this format. Thank you for participating today. You are the first up on our calendar today, October 21, 2021. I want to remind you, when you're not speaking, please hit your button so that we don't have people overlapping and they're talking, your mute button. Also, each of you will have 15 minutes. Our marshal, as I indicated, will have a clock that'll appear on the screen. I don't see it. There it is. All right. Each of you will have 15 minutes. An additional 5 minutes, of course, is reserved to appellate counsel if you choose to utilize that. I'll ask our marshal to now call the first case for presentation.
Now calling case number A210755, State of Minnesota versus Mark Zantelli.
Ms. LePage, when you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Janine LePage. I'm here representing the state in this pretrial appeal. This case comes before the court because a little girl, MP, who's now 7 years old, has forgotten the one-time sexual assault perpetrated on her by the respondent when she was just 4 years old. The fact that her developing brain does not keep in its current memory every trauma should be a blessing. But the ruling by the district court to suppress her videotaped statement at the Family Advocacy Center essentially destroys that blessing, and it violates established law. This case has essentially two issues.
Before you get to the issues of the case, it's very obvious you have to achieve or persuade us that you've reached critical impact. It's your burden. And if we don't get beyond that, there's no reason for this appeal. So how do you best defend this critical impact?
Your Honor, without the statement, the state has absolutely no evidence to go forward on charge, the first charge in the complaint, criminal sexual conduct in the first degree.
What's lacking? Because you have the victim's mother who is part of your part of the appeal that has the ability to testify, as well as a video that was made.
The court refused to allow the video. That's the issue. The court suppressed the video. The district court believes that the three questions that the mother asked MP somehow replace the evidence in the video. And that's the issue before the court. The child said to her mother, "Mark licked my privates." The mother said, "Are you sure?" And the child said, "Yeah, he laid me on his bed and licked my privates." And the mom said, "Did he take your clothes off?" And she said, "No." So therein lies the inherent problem with the first degree criminal sexual conduct charge, because it requires penetration. But one way to reach penetration is cunnilingus. I see no legal definition in 609 with respect to cunnilingus. So I'm relying on a, you know, Webster's dictionary definition, which requires the mouth to touch the bare genital. And so with what MP told her mother, and her mother quit asking her questions. Her mother had been a supervisor at a visitation center and knew that she shouldn't ask anything. And she called the police and they made arrangements for the interview at the FAC. So
you also have DNA evidence. Wasn't there evidence of saliva on the child's shorts?
There is, but it's the judge, the district court erroneously relied on a fact that there was amylase with defendant's DNA in the child's underwear. This is not true. There is no amylase there's in underwear, which would be indicative of genital contact. What we have, there was no underwear collected. Law enforcement failed to collect that. The mother provided the child shorts to law enforcement. There's amylase on the inner leg of the child's shorts. So without the statement at the FAC, the state has no way to explain how that got there, because the child says to her mom, "He didn't take my clothes off." in the interview at the FAC, the child explains, he opened my clothes. She says he took his hand and opened her shorts, which would indicate he lifted up her shorts. He pulled them aside and he performed cunnilingus on this little girl. That can't be explained without the FAC interview. Without the details that the child provides in that videotaped interview, we are left solely with, he licked my privates over my clothes because she says he didn't take them off. And now we have issues where he could say, oh boy, I licked my hand because I had eaten some cheese. And then I picked her up to carry her upstairs. You know, my hand probably, you know, I had her on my hip. My hand probably touched her inner thigh. You know, it got on her shorts. I mean, we're left with so much reasonable doubt and the state on the second degree, and the state has no evidence at all to present to a jury on the first degree regarding the cunnilingus allegation. So it not only significantly impacts the state's case, it basically destroys the state's case by not being able to present the videotaped interview of this child. The state does believe that it's met critical impact based on that. At that point, then the two issues and the main issue before the court, I mean, the district court found that the statement to the FAC was trustworthy. The court just found that the two remaining elements of 807 weren't met. So although that's an issue, the biggest issue really is the issue of the confrontation clause. And that's whether or not the confrontation clause is satisfied where MP, she's found competent. The judge made a finding that she's a competent witness. If she appears at trial to testify, but she doesn't have a current memory of the reported assault. And then the second one would be going through the 807 analysis and whether or not the statement is admissible.
So the page, what would this child testify if the state were to call her? And was there any sort of offer of proof made to the district court on that issue?
Your Honor, the state's belief, and obviously the child situation could change, but the state's understanding and what's been represented is that at this point, the child does not have any recollection whatsoever. The child appeared for the competency hearing. She did not recognize the respondent. She was not affected by being in the courtroom with him. The family moved out of the home. I don't know if this is in the record, but the family left.
Let me stop you just for a minute and we can stop the clock. Mr. Keller, are you able to see or hear us? We don't have you on screen. Oh, please stay on screen. I just want you to be muted, but you do need to be present and visible on screen. Thank you.
I was losing the internet connection, that's why.
Understood. I was just checking to make sure that everything was fine. I am sorry for the interruption, Ms. LePage. We did stop the clock. We'll start it going again.
No worries. I expect she would testify that she doesn't remember. She doesn't remember giving a statement. She doesn't remember the assault. She doesn't remember Mr. Zantelli. She doesn't remember living in the same building as Mr. Zantelli. She has no memory of this. I mean, so we have a videotape statement that was taken within a week of the assault. It's clear it's her giving the statement. We don't have a concern with that. This issue of memory, though, was specifically addressed by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2008 in the decision of State v. Holiday, 756 Northwest 7, 556. In that case, the witness had no memory of the statement that was previously made. And the issue was whether or not the Crawford decision, which indicates that the confrontation or that if a witness appears for cross-examination, it removes all confrontation clause barriers to the admission of his or her prior statement. Because it goes on to say that the declarant will defend or explain the statement. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Holiday interpreted that to mean that if they show up and they are present on the stand, whether they have a memory or not, whether they can talk about the prior statement or not, alleviates any confrontation clause issues. Once that's established, we're now left with whether or not this statement meets the criteria of 807. There's been a lot of focus placed on testimonial, non-testimonial. Unlike probably most cases with little kids and FAC interviews, this does not hinge on that. The state even conceded, although I think there are factors to support this not being a testimonial statement, the state conceded, let's consider it a testimonial statement. She is available. She can show up. She's been found competent. The judge went through a long questioning of her with respect to the issues involved in competency, and the court determined her to be competent. She was able to tell the difference between truth and a lie. She was able to talk about, you know, day-to-day things. She was able to talk about, you know, what school she went to, who her teacher was. She is a competent witness. She just doesn't have a memory. The issue is, how is this really different than any other case where we have a situation where someone gets on the stand and says, I don't remember? That's why we have hearsay exceptions. That's why we have the ability to use these prior statements that people have given. And there's various ways in which those can be admitted into evidence. And this falls squarely under Rule 807.
Is there a difference between not remembering anything, so there's no effective testimony given at all, and someone who remembers maybe some of the surrounding circumstances, but they don't remember the criminal act? Seems to me there's a distinction there, and because then there is an ability to cross-examine and make a claim of selective memory or something like that to call the witness's credibility into question, as opposed to a situation where, you know, a witness is called and they really can testify to nothing regarding the incident, any of the circumstances leading up to it. I mean, should we make a distinction between those two types of circumstances?
I think if the court makes a distinction, the court's overruling the decision in State v. Holiday.
But in the Holiday case, didn't Mr. Holiday testify to some of the surrounding circumstances, but just claimed a lack of memory to the issues that were involved in the statement that was played?
That's true, but the court didn't include that in its ruling. The court indicated that the confrontation clause is satisfied by a declarant's appearance at trial for cross-examination, and it is for the fact finder to evaluate a declarant's credibility. Accordingly, they talk about AA's memory infirmities were exposed at trial and the court could make a determination with respect to credibility. And I think if we're going to go that route, who's going to be the decision maker about at what point is this witness now not available for confrontation clause purposes? I mean, in the Crawford case, which is the most cited case on this issue, in the footnote, I mean, the Crawford case specifically states that if a declarant appears for cross-examination at trial, the confrontation clause places no constraints at all on the use of his prior testimonial statements. And so then are we going to determine that as long as you can remember one factor? So then do we have a situation where prosecutors are telling parents, make sure every month you remind your child that they went for this interview? I mean, where is this going to fall? We have a ruling, and I don't believe that there's anything before the court in this case that's so substantially different than other cases with small children who give statements. And when trials don't happen for 2 or 3 years, do we want to continue to refresh their recollections so that they remember for purposes of trial? This child gave a statement. There's no question that she's the one that gave it. There was cross-examination and inquiry of the person who took the statement from her with respect to the protocol that was used, that it was done with a non-leading, open-ended question situation where she used age-appropriate responses. The child was able to describe in her own words. In fact, at one point, the examiner said to her, I have one more question for you. When he licked your privates with his tongue, again, this is the only place she talks about him using his tongue, the only place she talks about him using his hands to open her shorts. But she says, did he lick you on your clothes or on your skin or something else? And she did not take one of those answers. She came up with her own and she said, he licked me under my clothes. And she was so definitive and so clear in that statement. And this ruling by the court, again, it violates current law, but it also creates a situation where a fact finder doesn't get to hear from this child who was very definitive and clear at the time of the incident. If the court were to overrule or modify the holding in Holiday, I mean, what happens when defendants intentionally delay trial? I mean, we try to get cases to trial. The rules specify that cases with little kids rise to the level of a, you know, a
but that isn't importance. The case here. There's not any effort or any allegation that the defense delayed the trial.
No, there isn't. I mean, we've tried to get to trial, and with the COVID, that delayed it. It was initially, though, delayed for over a year, I think, getting to that point. But there is not an allegation of that. Just briefly, since I'm almost out of time, the court in its order did not state any basis for saying that the state had not met the elements of B and C under Rule 807. Just simply stated they haven't been met, and there has been no information to support that. And I can address that on rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. LePage. Mr. Keller, you have the floor.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you just fine. Would you mind addressing critical impact? I seem to be stuck on that prong.
In your brief, you
touched on it only in a sentence or two.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Werke. I was planning on addressing that. Hopefully you'll be able to hear me throughout because I was losing Ms. LePage, which is not her fault, but there were some connection issues here. So I don't think critical impact has been met because the court's questions are correct. So a typical situation that we would see critical impact is, for example, in a DWI case, you have a charge of under the influence and you have a charge of testing 0.08 or more. The driver challenges some Fourth Amendment issue, and as a result, the test is suppressed. When the test is suppressed, then it's an absolute fact that the defendant cannot be tried for testing 0.08 or more because now the test is out. Now, that is not like this case, because here we have a corner house interview, which has been ruled to be not admissible. We still have a statement that the child made to her mother. And I understand this is not the state's position, but what I'm about to say is not the state's position, but I think that there's no reason why the state could not proceed on the basis of number one, the child has no memory whatsoever. So the child is not going to come in and say that anything happened. That's absolutely undisputed. We all agree on that. Number two is she made a statement to her mother shortly after returning back to the apartment, within an hour after returning to the apartment. The trial court says, and it's an excited utterance. I don't think it's admissible as an excited utterance, but it may be admissible as something else. But anyways, the trial court said it's admissible, and we have not challenged that on appeal. And so that is the law of the case right now, is that is admissible. And the state, back to the court today.
Mother, are you talking about the mother's statement? You have not challenged that.
That's correct. We did not challenge that. So the law of the case is that the child's statement to the mother is admissible. And the state quoted back to the court this morning what exactly that statement was. And the assistant county attorney said today that it was, quote, he licked my privates. Well, I would interpret that as something that could be contact or it could be penetration, but there's nothing in that statement that precludes the idea that there's penetration. So I think that's definitely sufficient evidence. If someone made a motion for judgment of acquittal that there's not sufficient evidence of penetration, I think, honestly, there is sufficient evidence of penetration in that statement. So I don't think there's critical impact because it doesn't preclude the state from prosecuting any charge that is brought in this case, unlike the example of when a test is thrown out in a DWI case, you cannot proceed on the test charge. That is not this case. So I don't think the state has shown critical impact.
So Mr. Keller, just in reading your brief though, you barely addressed it. I read your brief as almost conceding that issue. Why haven't you conceded it by not briefing it adequately?
Well, it's difficult to answer that. I can just say that this is an abbreviated process. As the court knows, the court has a duty to decide critical impact regardless of what we briefed or not. I think it's a jurisdictional issue, and I don't think we can waive or concede a jurisdictional issue. But that actually goes to another point, Judge Flory. So the state was just arguing that, well, what happens in all of these cases if there is a delay in going to trial, and the state is not arguing, as Judge Werke clarified and inquired of the state this morning, the state's not arguing that Mr. Zontelli did anything to delay this. But if anything has delayed this other than COVID, which we were basically ready to go to trial in March of 2020, right before the shutdown. So we certainly lost a year because of COVID, but you also have to keep in mind, if you talk about cases being delayed, the state has sought reconsideration of the trial court's ruling on this issue twice, because it's crystal clear, as I believe I wrote in my brief to this court, that the trial court has ruled on this issue three times. Now, you could say, well, the record wasn't good enough the first time and this and that and the other thing. But the fact of the matter is, in this case, where we have a declarant who can't remember anything, then it doesn't really do much good to present a record, because the record is there is no record, so to speak. We made a foundational record about the circumstances in which the corner house interview was made, that there was a police officer there and so on. There's some help to that in fleshing out the record, but that's not the meat of it, basically. So the state actually could have brought a pretrial appeal a long time ago. Instead, it sought to have the trial court make two more rulings after the first ruling on this issue. So if anything, there's a delay there. Judge Flory also asked about, is there a distinction between witnesses who remember some things and witnesses who remember nothing? I agree there is a distinction between those two things, because as Judge Flory suggested, you can be cross-examined when you say you remember some things, but when you remember nothing, it's really the same thing as in my brief when I suggested that in the Hammond portion of the Davis U.S. Supreme Court decision, the Hammond portion, H-A-M-M-O-N, dealt with an affidavit. Really, this is no different from the affidavit situation, because you have a piece of paper, that's an affidavit. You can't cross-examine an affidavit, just like you can't cross-examine a police report. And a police report is no different from an affidavit, except that an affidavit is sworn. And when you present a corner house video, and the situation is that the person who spoke on the corner house video, the declarant, is essentially unavailable. And I'm gonna get to that in a second. They can't answer any questions about what they said on the video or what actually happened, because their answer is, I don't remember anything. Now, on page 21 of my brief, I cited the rules of evidence as stating, as the trial court was referring to, at page 3 in its order from June 14th of this year, which is Mensa's document number 99, Rules of Evidence 804 state that the definition of unavailability of a witness includes situations in which the declarant, then it gives three examples. Number 3 is, quote, testifies to a lack of memory of the subject matter of the declarant's statement. So the declarant is clearly unavailable, even though she is physically available. So in spite of what Holliday says, the truth of the matter is Holliday doesn't really make much sense. And one of the judges this morning pointed out that in Holiday, the witness did remember something. I would also point out that one of the reasons I say Holiday doesn't make any sense is it's really in contradiction to other law. I pointed out on my brief on page 22 that whatever the basis of Holiday is, seemingly it can't magically undo Rule of Evidence 804.3 and somehow cause someone to believe that MP, the child in this case, is available for confrontation. The rules of evidence say she's not available for confrontation. I pointed out in my brief that Holiday was a murder trial that was held as a court trial, not a jury trial. And it doesn't really make sense to say that somehow this is fair when a person can go up there and say, I don't remember anything, then they clearly can't be subject to cross-examination because there's nothing that you can ask them. And in the rules of evidence, they talk about who is a competent witness. I've argued in the trial court that MP, the child in this case, is not a competent witness because you have to have some foundational knowledge about what you're supposed to testify to. If you have no memory, then to me, you're an incompetent witness. And then that sort of solves the Crawford problem in a sense, because then the person's not really available for cross-examination at all. As the assistant county attorney was reading the footnote out of Crawford,
if is there the any trial case court, law to support that argument, Mr. Keller, that unavailability due to lack of memory equates with a traditional incompetence determination, that being, you know, whether or not someone knows the difference between the truth and not telling the truth? Has any case law connected those two concepts?
I'm getting this message here saying my internet connection is unstable, so hopefully you can still hear me, but thank you for that question. To me, Judge Flory, there's two different things here. There's two different types of competence that have to be distinguished. The classical thing that happens with child witnesses is a trial court, as you have done when you were a trial court judge, does an examination of someone and they ask the child, do you know the difference between a truth and a lie, and so on? And that did happen in this case. Well, she was found to be competent in what I call general competence. She does know the difference between a truth and a lie. Now, that's a hearing that we had earlier this year. I'm not disputing that. I was there. But then there's what I would call specific competence. If a person can't remember anything, then to me, according to the rules of evidence, they're incompetent because it says that you have to have personal knowledge of what you're testifying to. I can't cite any cases on that. That's the answer to your question.
Did you raise this issue in district court challenging the determination of her competency and arguing this alternative theory that there's different levels of competency?
I did, Your Honor. And I think it's clear that there are two different types of competence, because you can know the truth from a lie, but if you don't know anything about the events, for example, we could say that, I don't know, maybe she's the sibling of the complainant and she doesn't know anything about it. Well, you can't call her as a witness and say, well, my mom told me that this happened or whatever. She doesn't know anything about it under that scenario. She's really not a competent witness. So we did argue it in the trial court. I think you Court of Appeals can uphold the trial court's ruling on any basis, including an alternative basis. And this is an alternative basis. and Judge Smith also asked about what the child would say. So, I mean, it's absolutely clear that the child would say that she doesn't remember anything. So to me, it's a violation of the evidence of Crawford and of due process for her to basically have her evidence or claimed testimony, whatever you want to call it, bootstrapped in, because what I've been arguing in the trial court and essentially here is that ordinarily a corner house video would be admissible as a basically previous statement and a consistent statement when the declarant goes up there and says, I can't remember anything, or the declarant doesn't testify because she's found to be lacking competence because she doesn't remember anything. Either way, it's a consistent statement. And so then what happens is the state is trying to bootstrap it in a different way because it can't introduce it in the standard way that we usually see in the trial court, which is as a consistent statement. So I don't think that the effort here is successful. I think we argued convincingly in our brief to this court and below that the statement is absolutely testimonial. The state said that it's conceded it, although there's some argument to be made. The state said that maybe it's not testimonial. So I think the trial court was correct in excluding the video, and I see that my time has expired.
Thank you. Ms. LePage, you have the final word, and I'm going to ask you a question just for clarification. You do concede that the video is testimonial. Is that, that's what I read and heard in your argument. Is that correct?
The state would concede that because this child is available for cross-examination.
All right. So then bear with me because I'm trying to figure out how this plays out. So if we agree you've met critical impact because the penetration needs to be an element and you only have that in the video, and it goes back to trial, you play the video, you have the mother's testimony, and the child is there. You would put as an offer of proof to the trial court, did you indicate you're going to put the child on and indicate you've pretty much said she's not going to say anything? Right. Is that what you would see as the trial unfolding?
I would see that she would be put on the stand, that the court, we would go through some basic information. I would ask her, do you remember the person sitting in this courtroom? Do you remember living? Do you remember? And she would say no. And defense counsel would be able to use that information. She might say yes. I mean, at this point, what she has said is no. And her behavior in the courtroom, she didn't even recognize him. So I would expect she doesn't. But she may end up, I know her mother, I think, said she probably does, but doesn't want to talk about it. She might remember. But at this point, she has said she doesn't remember.
Let me ask this. How does this provide for effective opportunity for cross-examination where the child doesn't remember anything?
There is no guarantee in the Constitution for effective cross-examination, and that's
but it does guarantee the opportunity for effective cross-examination.
It guarantees the opportunity for cross-examination, not effective cross-examination.
Doesn't it guarantee the opportunity for effective cross-examination? There's a difference.
The court in Holiday went through an extensive analysis with respect to that issue and cited Crawford, cited Fenster, cited U.S. Supreme Court in the Green case, and ultimately concluded that there is no ultimate right for an effective cross-examination that goes the way you want it to go.
But the language in the Holiday case says the Confrontation Clause guarantees a criminal respondent the opportunity for effective cross-examination, not cross-examination that is effective. So if how do you guarantee opportunity for effective cross-examination when the person doesn't remember anything?
How is it different than any other witness that takes the stand and says, I don't remember, which happens routinely? It happens routinely in domestic.
Excuse me, but isn't the difference here that you're left then with just the statement that you can't possibly cross-examine the contents of that statement? That seems to me to be not effective opportunity for cross-examination.
Well, the court in Holiday cited the Fenster case and said not cross-examination that is effective in whatever way and to whatever extent the defense might wish. And in this case, like many cases, this court has upheld this issue in multiple unpublished decisions since the Holiday decision was issued. And if the court affirms the district court suppression order, this court is essentially overruling Holiday. How much time do I have left? Counsel cites this whole thing with the rules of evidence somehow controlling. These are different issues. The issue of confrontation is a confrontation clause issue. Once that issue is met, now we have the issue of, is this statement admissible under the rules? And counsel is citing, is kind of mixing and matching Rule 804 with Rule 807. 803 are exceptions that don't involve availability of the declarant. Rule 804 are specific exceptions that involve and require unavailability of the declarant. And one way that a declarant can be unavailable is not remembering. That's not governing of Rule 807. And Rule 804 notes that there's a difference between unavailability of the testimony and unavailability of the declarant. And here we have availability of the declarant. She's present. And my time is up.
Right on time. All right. Thank you to both counsel for your appearance today on our Zoom platform. The matter is deemed submitted and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.